Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Well, from heads of state and government and sovereigns in Rome, we have actual literary royalty now in the studio today. Donal Ryan, good afternoon.
Hi, Dervil, how are you doing?
Really, really well. Look, we're delighted to have you here. Twice nominated for the Booker Prize for obviously for The Spinning Heart and Alone in a Quiet Sea, which is has been adapted into a play
is
coming to Dublin's Gaiety Theatre soon. We're going to get to talk about all of that and your fantastic career through the prism of five songs that have meant something very special to you throughout your life. Your first choice is a Pokes number. You're a big Pokes fan.
I am, absolutely. And I just love this song so much because it just feels so authentic, like every Pogue song, but it really is, like it's such a lovely tribute by Shane McGowan to his childhood native place, because he spent most of his childhood in
Tipperary. Mm-hmm. You moved to Nina when you were, eight or nine?
I think it was just shy of nine, and we moved 4 miles from the village of Newtown, Yohalara, and straight in the road to Nina, and it just felt like a different world completely, even though I knew the town well, of course.
Why did it feel like such a culture shock?
I suppose, like, going from a small village to, you know, a small town, to me it felt huge, obviously. It just was so different. People spoke differently. It's amazing the difference, actually, now people spoke between the village and the town. Just kind of a slow, easy drawl in the town and kind of a more kind of rapid fire kind of dramatic in the village. So it was an adjustment. I changed schools as well because mum and dad didn't want me getting a bus to school for some reason. So
Your big changes in the life of a young child, your parents actually, you're probably your love of books comes from them, but your grandmother also loved books, especially the band ones.
She did. May Ryan, Nee Barry. They lived in a house in Pellis Beg. They were caretaker farmers, my grandparents. And she was related distantly to Edna O'Brien, but she used to take care of Edna when she was a teenager and Edna was a baby over in East Clare. And when Country Girls was banned, my grandmother smuggled in a copy from England, and then she became a purveyor of banned books. She became a librarian of banned books. She had books by J.P. Dunleavy and Edna O'Brien, Kate O'Brien, any book that was banned, really. Brendan Behan, she had them all.
Was she sort of distributing them around the place?
She was. People, I mean, was a Pat Warren apparently from the road up to the up the Boreen, up to the cottage to by big shots, you know, by solicitors and judges and parish priests, people who really wanted to get these books, their hands in these books, you know,
and to find a way through your granny. Your parents obviously were readers and books were a big part of your culture. Do you find that, I mean, that's my memory of growing up, there was always books, there's no obviously devices. Do you think we're, you know, obviously there were less distractions then, so we lived in a world of books?
Oh yeah, like my parents had a real talent for finding job lots of books in place. Like, they had no money like everybody else in the 80s. And so they'd find boxes of books at jumble sales and house auctions, you know, probably for a pound for a huge box of books or less even. And so the house was always full of books and every kind of book. You know, the only book I wasn't allowed to read was I, Claudius by Robert Graves, because Mam had seen, she'd glimpsed an episode of the very, very salacious BBC adaptation of it, which is nonstop sex, basically. And so
she
that book was banned
that
for a while, yeah. And I still feel slightly like, you know, I'm going against men when I read it these days, but
you've got over that. I know obviously going from Newtown to Nina was a big, big move in your life, but it probably was there that you created, or I suppose this ability to describe small time Ireland and the lives of really, really ordinary people. But as you say, no one had money back then. Mm. Everyone was ordinary.
Absolutely.
Your parents, your parents came from a modest background.
Oh yeah, I mean, I was always surprised actually at the start. My first books came out when people started to describe me as somebody who described ordinary lives, because to me I was just describing lives. You know, I wasn't saying, well, this is the working class. Look, you know, this is just where my people. I was describing my own family, my own friends, the people I grew up with, people I love. So it was no distinction for me. But I suppose that the idea that I can somehow channel or ventriloquise the so-called rural demotic. I suppose it's true, because I try to stay as authentic as and as true as possible to the voices of Irish rural working class people.
But your family were involved in your success, because like, I mean, your mother was involved, not like your grandmother in the banned books, but in the signing of books after the huge success of The Spinning Heart.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I remember working Tesco's for years and years in Nina, and people would chew at her tail to ask about characters in Spinning Heart, which is was very gratifying for me, but a bit annoying for her. And she would always say, "Will you please just write a sequel to The Spinning Heart?" So people would stop asking me. But Bobby Mahon in particular, the main character in Spinning Heart, people were particularly worried about Bobby, and people would really be concerned and go, "And how's Bobby now? Like, where is Bobby exactly?" Because it's not that clear at the end. It is a bit ambiguous at the end of The Spinning Heart.
And did people think that they recognised, for want of a better phrase, their own kind?
Oh yeah. Oh, I mean, people would actually literally recognise people. People would have a list of people who they thought, they'd have the character name and the real person in their mind, you know.
Yeah. And your mum, when she left actually Tesco, did they retire her till as well?
They did, for a while anyway. No one used her till, and it was a lovely little shrine to her at the door, which was lovely. She was very loved, you know. People had great affection for her.
I suppose I better get to a bit of music, this being the purpose of the five songs. Your first song is one of Shane McGowan's Ode to Tipperary. Tell us what it is.
It's The Broad Majestic Shannon, and it is really, I mean, it's sung from the point of view of an immigrant in London, in an Irish club, having a whiskey on a Sunday and thinking back. And I love the way he gives this kind of almost sacred importance to objects, you know, the rusty tin can and the old hurling ball, and the memories they can evoke, and how you can be transported straight back to the place. You know, he describes the sound of music being played and cards being dealt. And it is apparently funny, because I know Siobhan well, and she's a great friend of mine, through my cousin Gillian Ryan, actually, we became friends. And Siobhan tells me that it is pretty much accurate, as close as you can get, description of the scenes that they witnessed as children in Clochjordan.
And why so many people resonated with Shane McGowan's words and his lyrics. This is The Broad Majestic Shannon by The Pogues. It's a great track. Your next song is something a little bit different, because it's an AC/DC track. Were you a wee bit of a rocker when you were younger?
Yeah, I mean, it was very clear divides between groups in Nina when I was growing up. So I was one of the heavy metalers. I kind of collectively refer to my friends in my teenage years as the Hamilton Drive-Bys, because they're mostly from an estate called Hamilton Drive. And we all wore back patches, AC/DC and Iron Maiden, bit of Led Zeppelin here and there if you were kind of an aristocrat. We weren't very sporty, we weren't hurlers, so we were FCM members and metalers. It kind of almost went together, even though there was a bit of a clash there. You know, you couldn't have long hair if you were the
FCA. That was your tribe.
So. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But this song is on, I first heard it actually on a tape after radio, and then about a week later on a school tour in first year, I saw it on the album Who Made Who, and this chap called Michael Morgan, who I didn't know very well at the time, we became very good friends afterwards. He said, "Man, you should buy that. You should be into AC/DC." You know, it was a very generous thing for him to say, "This guy isn't that cool, you know, but I can kind of show him very gently how to be cool, you know?
I can maybe make him a little bit cool."
Oh, Michael's such a lovely fella. Yeah, he was, and this song always reminds me of him. I remember one day we were walking through town when we were friends, and we were all broke and bored on a summer's day, and Mick spotted a £5 note on the ground, and he rejoiced. I mean, he jumped around for joy, and then and then he went off and bought us all Mr. Freeze's, giant Mr. Freeze's. I think they were like 30 pence, but he bought one for everybody, you know. It was fantastic. Great memory.
What is the name of the track?
You Shook Me All Night Long by AC/DC.
Okay, no, not too much of the long hair now, but I know you're going to channel that inner heavy metaler from your youth. This is Donal Ryan's second musical choice today. It is AC/DC, You Shook Me All Night Long. And that was a good investment for £4 to buy that tape with that track on it. Can I bring you back, Donal Ryan, to, can you remember what was your earliest iteration of wanting to be a writer or knowing that was your path? Or when did you first start even experimenting writing yourself?
Well, very early on. I mean, I loved stories and loved books and used to just get totally lost in comics and just used to get totally lost in them. But the first time I wrote a story I remember was when Barry McGuigan lost his featherweight title to Steve Cruz, and I was just heartbroken because I love Barry so much, still do. And when my dad said, sure, you should write a story about Barry getting his title back, because, you know, all time had passed and Barry retired, it didn't look like it was going to happen, because I'd been kind of promised, you know, the night it happened, don't worry, there'll be a rematch in Ireland and Barry will get it back, don't worry. And so I wrote that story, and
what
we had
a rematch
in Nina and in McDonough Park, and, you know, I had Barry winning, going the distance, hugging Steve at the end, and Barry's dad singing Danny Boy. I remember the story really, really clearly, actually. And I felt such relief. I felt like, oh God, it felt like it had really happened, because, you know, I admit it happened in my imagination. It just felt so real.
What age were you when you wrote that?
Well, I would have been 10, because that was 86, I think, that Barry lost his title, yeah.
And was it then just, I know obviously you'd grown up in that culture of books, was it just sort of a growing sort of a realisation that that is something that you wanted to do? It's not really something you put on your UCAS form.
No, it was just there consistently in my head all the time. And the only thing I ever saw myself as being was a writer. And even when I was all sorts of different things, working in meat factories and in the civil service and in driving forklifts and doing all sorts of different things in my life and, you know, being a student, I still knew, like, the one thing I should be is a writer. You know, I didn't really talk about it very much,
Did you resist it?
I did, yeah. I mean, I used to burn. I'd start writing things and I'd burn them. I'd feel really ashamed. And I used to feel it wasn't good enough. And I'd feel embarrassed about the whole thing. And if I had written it in handwriting, I'd burn it straight away in the sink. So it would be, you know, it would cease to exist. Or I'd print stuff out just so I could ceremonially burn it, you know, just to make sure that there was no vestige left of this foolishness. So nothing I ever wrote felt right for years and years.
And can I talk to you about your life in the civil service? Because obviously many people know that. And often, you know, or on occasion rather, people who work in the civil service can take a bit of flack. Did you enjoy that work?
Flack. Yeah, I did. I loved it. I can't remember a bad day. I absolutely loved it. You know, and I started as a clerical officer at 22. And when I left civil service, I was an EO. So I hadn't climbed the ladder very much now. And I was working for NERA, the National Employment Rights Authority. And I absolutely loved every day of the jobs that I did in the civil service. It's a great place to work. I mean, sure, the opportunities you're afforded, you know, and just job security is an amazing thing. It really is. And I know, like...
Especially for writers.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, you know, that's a tragedy. When I had all the time, you know, when I was working as a clerical officer and didn't have to take work home and didn't have to dwell in my work after work, you know, I could finish at 5 or 6 or whatever and go home. I had all this time, you know, I had no kids, you know, I just all this time free to write and couldn't do it. And then when I had no time at all and we had kids and life was hectic and crazy, that's when I started to do it seriously.
I always think that every writer I know wants to be a lawyer. Every lawyer I know wants to be a writer. ended up...
That was the first thing, yeah.
You nearly ended up as a lawyer.
Oh, yeah. Well, I remember just, like, saying to my sister once, we worked in the same office going, like, the pay is just so bad, you know. I said, like, I suppose there's no chance, like, I'll ever be rich. And she goes, you could be if you were a lawyer, because she was saying, those barristers in tribunals get, like, £1,000 a day or something mental like that. And I went, whoa, that'd be nice. So she had spotted an ad for an evening law degree in UL. I did that and I was gung-ho, like I was, you know, I was mad to be a barrister or a solicitor. And I was thinking about doing FE1s around the time I got my first publishing deal. So that was it then, really.
There is a woman who is intrinsic to your writing career, and that is Anne-Marie.
Yeah.
Was that, where did you meet your wife, and how did she become, I suppose, that linchpin to actually getting you from thinking about writing a book to actually writing a book?
Well, we first met on a picket line in Limerick. I was the chairman
the
of Shannon Branch.
Of it all.
Yeah, exactly. I was chairman of the Shannon Branch of the CPSU at the time, and agriculture were on strike. And myself and my friend Anthony went into Limerick to march in solidarity with lunchtime, and we met again a good few months later in Clossie's, the great pub in Limerick, used to be Clossie's.
Shockingly, she remembered your name and you did not remember hers.
No, actually, so the way around, she thought I was called Tony, which is fair enough, like, because, you know, most people call me Donny. And she said, Tony, how are you doing? And I don't think I remember hers. But I kind of knew after about the second time we met that I would ask her to marry me. Now, I didn't know we'd get married because I couldn't say that for sure, but I just knew that she was the person for me. And I wouldn't be a writer. Like, I definitely wouldn't be a writer if she hadn't made me do it, you know, and hadn't had faith in me. And I kind of found my voice, really, when we met properly.
And that brings us to our next song, which is for Anne-Marie. It's a song that was sung at your wedding. What sort of a day was it?
Oh, it was a brilliant day. we didn't do, I mean, we were very lax. Like, I remember Anne-Marie being really unfairly called a bridezilla because she was the least bridezilla bride of all time. Like, we just went with the flow. We ended up having our wedding in our local church in Munaleen in Limerick. We're married by Monsignor Dennehan and a lovely priest. And we had our reception in Bunratty, and it was just the best crack. It was brilliant. It was a great day, you know. And we met, we were in the pub 2 nights before the wedding, and we happened to meet a bagpiper by chance. And he said, "Let's come to your wedding in Bunratty," because he heard us talking about it. And it looked really organised and professional. You know, this fantastic bagpiper walked us into the reception.
Picked up before you went in.
Our friend Patricia Hearn sang this song, "The Lark in Clear Air," beautifully in Mullaline Church as we went into the church. Another thing that looked like it was really, really, you know, so well organised, like, and it was, because Patricia is a great singer, but I just love this song. It's one of Anne-Marie's favourite songs, and so this is for her.
And it is. This is for Anne-Marie. This is Donal Ryan's third song choice today. This is "The Lark in the Clear Air" by Cara Dillon.
Oh, my fond heart longs to say.
It's an absolutely stunning, stunning piece. And as often happens, Donal Ryan, sometimes in life the greatest joys can be met by the greatest challenges or sadnesses. And you had just, after 47 or so rejection letters, you get this big publishing deal that changes the course of your lives. But Anne-Marie also got some news that changed the course of your lives.
She did. Around the time I got my first publishing deal, she was diagnosed with cervical cancer. So it was a bit of a blow. But she got through it, you know. Luckily, a lot of people don't. So just by pure luck, you know, she was caught early and she had a radical hysterectomy days later. Yeah. And then poor Anne-Marie, she was diagnosed with breast cancer a few years ago at the start of COVID, actually. So she had a double whammy.
Wow.
Got through it again. So she's tough out, you know. But I mean, like, as someone was saying recently, like, that idea of a battle with cancer and losing and winning, like, it's not the right phraseology for it at all.
No.
You know, it's just so much luck involved and so much good fortune and bad fortune. So
yeah, the language doesn't befit it at all. But obviously, thankfully, she has come through that. When you look back at, you know, the Spinning Heart, the bigger nomination, how vivid is that still in your memory, or is it all a bit of a blur?
Kind of, it's a blur, all right, actually. Yeah. You know, it's kind of compressed into the last 13 years or so, and like, our lives didn't change too much. Like, we still live in the same house. We've kind of the same level of
still had to do the laundry.
Success or otherwise. Like, exactly, yeah. I met a guy one time and he goes, "Where do you live?" I said, "I live in Castletroy." He goes, "Like, whereabouts in Castletroy?" I said, "An estate called Woodhaven." He goes, You live in a housing estate?" He goes, "I thought you live in a castle." You're serious. That's Casto. So, yeah, but so things haven't changed very much for us, really. I just do feel that I'm in the right job. You know, I work in UL as a lecturer in creative writing, and I write a book pretty much every year. So it just feels like I'm doing what I should be doing. Mm.
But does it change your life? You know, you're getting that recognition. You know, I know you're a bit of a home bird, but, you know, you're being called upon to travel, to, you know, to do all of those very, very public events.
Yeah, I'm a bit resistant to travel, really. It's terrible. I'm a real home bird. So I try not to, but I end up having to travel a bit, right? Yeah. Reluctantly. And I always enjoy it in the end, but I'm not somebody who's enthusiastic about it.
Yeah. Talk to me about the first book you actually wrote was the thing about December, which didn't actually get published first, but it does link us into your next song, which is an Enya track. Talk to me about that.
Oh, yeah. So when the thing about December, when I was writing it, Anne-Marie was pregnant with her first child, and she loved the book, and she made me promise I wouldn't stop writing it. And I did, you know, around the time Thomas was born, I stopped, obviously, because I had no choice. And she kept saying, "Please, please finish the novel." And my mum as well was really disappointed. You know, she was very quietly supportive, and she was thrilled to hear that I was writing a book. You know, and when I didn't continue with it, she was kind of heartbroken. And then when it was finished and she read it, she just fell in love with Janzi, the main character. Like, Mam used to almost set a place at the table at home for him. And when she heard, actually, that Spinning Heart was going to be published first, she was distraught. She goes, "Oh, that's..." And she said, "Oh, poor old Janzi, that's the way it always was for him. He was always pushed aside," you know, and she spoke about him in those really, very real terms. But Anne-Marie and I would sit down at the table and we'd compose an imaginary screenplay for The Thing About December, and we'd cast it. I think we'd Michael Fassbender up on stage playing Janzi. Now, in fairness, there was a beautiful film bed called Fusca in the Irish language, directed by Sean Brannock and produced by Paddy Hayes, and Donal O'Haley, a great actor, played Janzi, and it was beautiful. But in Anne-Marie and my imaginary screenplay, we had this song playing by Enya playing over John Z's body. Actually, a bit of a giveaway there at the end, and kind of camera panning upwards. Yeah, and we really, and we, I was remember we had composed the whole scene. You know, we choreographed it. You know, and we had the soundtrack and the whole lot in our heads. So it just reminds me of that time, that lovely, hopeful time before I had a publishing deal. We were sitting down and talking about these imaginary things.
Yeah, it is interesting. Lots of messages coming in for you, but one of them said, only a writer could go from AC/DC to Cara Dillon. It's absolutely brilliant. So from AC/DC to Cara Dillon to Fallen Embers by Enya. This is Donal Ryan's fourth musical choice today. Absolutely gorgeous. The only thing worse than not writing a book is writing a book. What's next for you?
Well, I've written, finished a new novel that, well, I say finished, but it's been edited yet, so that's kind of the slog, really. So that'll be, it's slated for June 2026. That's the next thing that I'm doing. But
you're not giving too much away.
No, I get given out all the time for saying too much about books that haven't been published yet. Like, so.
But what we can talk about, Donal Ryan, is From Alone, Quiet Sea. It's adapted from your Booker-nominated book of the same name, and it's going to be in Dublin's Gaiety Theatre from April 29th to May 3rd. It's excellent that it's coming to the Gaiety. Can you share with us what is your fifth and final track for today?
It's Empty by Rilla Montaigne, and can I just say that the play, I'm credited with adapting it, but Andrew Flynn and the original cast did an incredible job adapting it. It's so worth seeing. It's better than the book. It's fabulous. It really is. And my final track is Empty by Rilla Montaigne, kind of for a dour reason, really. Now, I love the song, and Rilla Montaigne's fabulous, but the line, I never learned to count my blessings, I choose instead to dwell on my disasters, kind of describes me sometimes, you know. I do tend to dwell on my misfortunes sometimes, and I find it hard sometimes to climb out, and I really need to be dragged out of that kind of mire sometimes. So it's a very powerful song in lots of ways. So the lyrics are fantastic.
I'm sure that's something that many people can resonate with. We are going to play out, Donal, with your fifth and final musical choice. It has been an absolute pleasure for you to join us today. I can't even get to all of the messages that are coming in for you, but it has really been an absolute pleasure. So closing out, this is Empty by Ray LaMontagne.
So